supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
College basketball, Villanova hosts Cincinnati at 2, Temple's at Fordham at 4. And on the women's side, in A-10 tournament action, LaSalle versus St. Bonaventure at noon, St. Joe's is at Richmond at 2:30, and Duquesne meets Temple at 5. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very important question of the week for you today. There is some information going around on the World Wide Web that we are due for a tremendous case of late tomato blight this coming season, and it turns out that the plant pathologists who've been following late blight don't agree with any of this. Some very important information coming up for anyone who's growing tomatoes, which I assume is all he is. Plus, of course, lots of your fascinating phone calls, because it's a phone call show, at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you today?
I am doing just fine today, sir. How is Chris?
I'm doing great, thank you.
And where is Chris?
I'm in Alexander City, Alabama.
Oh, okay, very good. What part of Alabama is that?
We are East Central, so we're about 45 minutes southwest of Auburn.
Oh, okay, very good. What can we do for Chris in Alabama?
Well, I'm having a terrible time with my seed starts. I keep getting this powdery-looking stuff that grows on top of them. I'm looking at them right now. It doesn't quite look like mold, and I can touch them. I'm touching them right now, and it feels more like it might be some sort of fungus or something.
Now, are you using soil-free mix?
I am, yes.
And
I bought a commercial seed starter mix.
Okay, nothing wrong with that. But you say commercial. Is it one of these things with water-holding crystals or chemical fertilizer?
There's no chemical fertilizer that I'm aware of, but it's a mix of perlite and peat moss.
Okay, well, nothing wrong with that. The seed starting mixes that I use tend to be perlite, vermiculite, peat moss, a little bit of compost, a little bit of lime or wood ash to adjust the pH. You know, you didn't just combine perlite and peat moss, right?
No. I bought it already prepared.
Okay. And do you have heating mats?
I do, yes. I did start them with heating mats. And right now I started about 12 of these little containers last week. And I've got a few little tomato sprouts, but that's it. None of the peppers are coming up.
Okay. Peppers take longer to germinate, and they need higher temperatures. What kind of peppers are you trying to start?
We'll see. I have some Thai peppers and some bell peppers. Yeah.
You may find, I expect the sweet peppers will be up soon. You may have to actually feed the hot peppers a little bit of nitrogen. Hot peppers in nature go through the gut of a bird before they germinate. The birds
so
eat
maybe
the
some compost tea or something?
No, nitrogen, like you buy a little bat guano and make a little solution with liquid and soak the seeds in that and then plant them. Then you'll see some hot pepper action.
Do I not need to worry about this stuff that's growing
on
top
of them?
Well,
we're getting back to it. Now, obviously, you kept the soil really saturated while you were waiting for your seeds to germinate.
Right.
After these tomatoes came up, did you take them off the heat and cut back gravely on the water?
Yes. And I've got them under a shop light right now, and the light is right over the top of them.
Man, you're doing a lot of things right.
Hey, I went to your website.
And do you have any plain peat moss?
I do, yes. I cover the top of all of them with plain peat moss.
You are doing everything right. Why are you having the... What color did you say this stuff was?
It's kind of a bluish-green color.
Now, have you tried just physically removing this stuff as if it was like a little carpet or anything?
Yeah, I have, and it just comes right back.
It just comes right back. And you've got them under lights. And you haven't fed them anything yet.
No.
Right? And you're not overwatering them. And you've turned the heat off. And how many starts do you have in each cell?
I've got one in each cell right now. Actually, I use the cell that I bought, I'm using for flowers. The vegetables mm-hmm. that I have are growing in some yogurt containers.
Oh, is the mold in one or the other?
Well, I just did the flowers today, so they wouldn't have had a chance to grow, but the mold is in the yogurt containers, yes.
Oh, so you didn't use garden six packs. It's the only thing.
No, not. Mm-mm.
It's the only thing you deviated from. You know what's going on?
What's that?
No matter how well you rinse these things, some of the yogurt cultures have survived.
And so it's some sort of bacteria in there.
Yeah, you know, and maybe not a bad one. This is interesting. This is what happens when you use homemade containers. You got two choices. One is you can very carefully transfer these to real garden starter packs, you know, the ones you've saved from the garden centers. Or you can just continue growing them out and see, is there any indication at all that this material is having a negative effect?
Mm-mm, not that I can tell.
And you can take a toothpick and stick it into the soil, and at times the toothpick is dry in between waterings.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Well, that's what's happening. We actually got a little bit of the yogurt culture to carry over, and it likes that warm, wet environment you've provided, mm-hmm. the warm, wet, acidic environment. The other thing you could do, and you would have to do this so delicately, do you burn wood, or do you know anybody who's got a wood stove mm-hmm. or a fireplace?
Yeah, we do. We sure do.
You could dust the tiniest bit of wood ash into the top of this peat moss layer, and that'll create an environment where this stuff can't continue. But I'm certain it's from the yogurt cultures, and I'm not certain it's a bad organism.
Huh, okay. Well, I'll try the wood dust then.
Okay. All right, very good, Chris. Very interesting.
All right, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right, you take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. I'm in Haddonfield, a Philadelphia suburb.
Okay, very good.
I have lovely lilacs, but they've been attacked by vines.
Vines?
Yeah, different kinds of vines. Last spring it was like three different kinds, and then the honeysuckle came along.
Oh, good Lord, Joan. Did you plant it?
No.
It kind of just blew in with the birds,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, it just arrived, and I just don't know how to get them all out. You have to unwrap them from around the lilacs.
Well, that's one of the interesting secrets here, Joan, is you don't. You would only have to do that if you'd been attacked by something like mistletoe that parasitizes the plant. These vines, the vines that are being so tenacious for you, may wrap around the plant, but they don't take any nutrition from it, and they don't enter the cellular structure of the plant. So all you have to do, and all you ever should do, quite honestly, is slice the vines off where they're coming out of the soil and then let the top part die on the plant, and then it'll be much easier to remove. As you know, if you try to pull these healthy, vigorous vines off the lilacs, you can do a lot of damage to the lilac.
Yeah.
Let's back up a little bit. Lilacs demand morning sun, and they demand to have an empty bed. They don't want to have anything underneath them. They don't want to have any other plants growing near them. Do you have a ground cover, or are your lilacs crowded by other plants?
No.
So what do you have underneath them?
Well, just dirt.
Oh, okay. Very good. It's less work than you think. I would urge you to go out to a garden center and look around in the hoe section and find yourself a brand new hoe with a very super sharp blade that is big enough to sever these things. So none of this, like getting down on your hands and knees, doing this over and over again. As soon as the vine comes out of the ground, that's when you really want to sever it. If you keep severing the vine at ground level repeatedly over the course of a season, the root system will die without you actively engaging the root system. I would also urge you to find a nice supply of compost, true compost, not composted manure, but black yard waste compost. You can sometimes get it in bulk, get it in a bag. Give your lilacs a mulch of 2 inches of compost underneath the plant. The lilac will absolutely love it. It's a natural food. It's a natural disease preventative. And it will also slow down the vines and make them thinner and more vulnerable when they do break the surface, so you won't have any trouble slicing them off with this sharp hoe. And if we get halfway through the season or in next year and you can see you're really making progress, but it's getting a little harder, all that means is you need to get your hoe sharpened again. You should not be doing a lot of work. Piling up large amounts of mulch under the lilac will hurt the lilac. This is a case of just once a week getting out there, looking underneath the plant. If you see anything you don't like, sever it, and you will win without breaking a sweat or doing a lot of hard work or hurting your lilac.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, Joan, we wish you many, many more years of happy lilacking.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and say, let the games begin. Pitchers and catchers are working out the winter rust in spring training, and seed starters in warm climates are putting their first plants of summer to be into warm and wet soil-free mix. The official start of a new season of triumph, tragedy, and tomatoes. But don't go looking for all the details on how to correctly start your seeds in the A to Z Garden Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and very important information about the potential for a bad case of late blight on tomatoes this summer. I'm Blighted Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com. Temperature hanging in there at 51 degrees in Center City. This is WHYY.
Law can be an instrument of change. That's why the Widener Law Program is a practice-based legal education from a faculty of respected legal scholars and practitioners. Classroom learning is reinforced with hands-on experience through clinics, externships, trial simulations, and much more. And the Delaware campus, located in the heart of America's corporate capital and in close proximity to many of the nation's leading healthcare providers, is a place to focus on corporate and health law. Learn more at law.widener.edu. Widener Law supports WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on meaningful use and profitability, Thursday, March 8th at the Ritz-Carlton, Philadelphia. Details at athenahealth.com/philly.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. We have a very important question of the week coming up a little bit later. Cats and kittens, there's a internet thing going around warning that it's going to be a real bad tomato blight season and saying why these people think that and what you should do. And there's some things in there that are very ill-advised. So we'll be talking to our favorite plant pathologist to get the details straight of how you can avoid tomato blight in your garden this summer. You won't want to miss it. Well, this would normally be a time for me to call out the phone number and pick up a call from a listener, but this time we're going to turn things around. Our good friend and frequent advisor on fruit trees and pruning, Dr. Lee Reich, has a new book out. We'll put this man on the spot. Lee Reich, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden, pal.
Good to be here again. So I had a choice of putting in a sump pump or talking to you.
Well, boy, there's not a lot of difference there, Lee, to tell you the truth. Now, is it Growing Fruit Naturally? Is that the name of your new book?
close. It's grow fruit naturally.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just a different form of the verb. Now, Lee, you got your quote-unquote start in our world, or at least you became best known by writing about uncommon fruits worthy of attention. And then you moved on to landscaping with fruit, where you talked about the ornamental quality of the various edible fruits that were out there. But this appears to be the big one, because as you and I have discussed on the show many times, it can be really challenging to grow tree fruits like apples and peaches because they are subject to so many ills.
Yeah, that's true. So the reason for this book is really just to put in one place sort of everything you need. The average person even just needs to just open up a book. Here's how to do it. Here's what would be good to grow. Here's what would be harder to grow. And here's how to do it naturally.
And do you agree with me that I named the two hardest to grow?
East of the Rocky Mountains, yes. Apple's definitely the hardest. And peaches are up there. The plums could be also up there.
Now, you know, it's funny because you and I are the opposite on that. I think peaches are harder than apples, but I think they're both fighting pretty hard for the heavyweight championship.
Right. Unless if you live in California, you just plant them and pretty much you get a lot of fruit.
Well, there's another reason to get out of Dodge, isn't there? Yeah. You and I have talked very recently at length about the need for proper pruning.
Oh, yeah.
About the need for fruit thinning.
Right.
But then there are these insects that want to eat the fruit before you do, and then there's some heartbreaking diseases. I don't know what your biggest problem is with apples, but I would beg you for help with brown rot on peaches.
Right. Yeah. Well. So I think that sort of begs the question of like the most important thing before you. I think everybody should plant fruit just because if you don't grow your own fruit, you don't know what you're missing, at least some fruits, as far as a really good flavor. I mean, what you can grow is so much better than anything you can buy, even at farm stands often.
My wife has said the same thing. Even when we've had a peach harvest that I've been really unhappy with, I didn't get the size I wanted, bugs got to too many of them. She said she was more than happy to cut away any bad parts because my worst peach was better than the best supermarket peach I had ever brought home.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So really, the most important thing, I think, if anybody wants to really realize this gustatory pleasure, is planning. Although, actually, I should backtrack and say before, the most important thing is to buy my book. And then you know how to do the planning. And really, an important part of planning is planning what to grow, because you have to realize that if you're not going to want to pay a lot of attention to pest problems, for instance, you should not grow apples east of the Rocky Mountains. But there's plenty of other fruits. The problem is that people, when they think of planting fruits, their mind immediately gravitates to apple. It's not the only fruit.
Right, and you have specialized in the past. I think your landscaping with fruit went into a lot about the easy care aspects of the good looking
fruits. Yeah,
there's
a lot of fruits that are much easier, and a lot of fruits that, even known fruits, unknown fruits. And the book also includes all the berries. Berries are, first of all, they taste unbelievable when you grow them yourself, and they're very easy to grow.
One of the reasons I'm still a gardener today is when I met my wife, who I started my first garden to please, the first thing she wanted is raspberries. How lucky was that?
Good move.
Yeah, because they grow themselves.
Yeah, they're easy to grow, and they taste so unbelievable. And if you do like them and you buy them in the supermarket, they cost a fortune.
Exactly. They're a high-value crop, which is what I'm always telling small-scale farmers.
One reason to grow fruits is you can just feel rich, all the stuff you get.
So now, when we do grow, and I don't know about you, but I have noticed a trend among gardeners. More and more people are daring to get into fruit trees. I see a real spike in my emails.
No, that's 100% true. I've noticed that also. It's used to be that, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, everybody was just growing flowers. Then people realized, growing vegetables, how good they could taste and how healthful they are. Plus, you don't have to worry about, where they ship somewhere with some salmonella. And now people are doing the next level, getting into fruits.
Now, obviously, if you are going to grow the difficult fruits, the apples and the peaches east of the Rockies, one thing that has become helpful is all of the organic sprays that have appeared over the past couple of decades. We have a replacement spray for any of the chemical sprays that are out there. And as you and I know, some, quote, conventional fruits are sprayed heavily, literally every week, right, Lee?
Oh, yeah. Most conventional tree fruits are sprayed weekly or maybe every 2 weeks throughout the growing season.
And, Lee, of all the different organic sprays that home gardeners can utilize, where do you put Surround this micronized clay spray that puts a thin film on the plants that theoretically prevents disease spores and insects from actually touching any parts of the plant?
Yeah, well, it actually does other things. It deters insects in more than just by coating the fruit. So this is a clay spray. Where do I put it? First of all, I think it's really been somewhat of a godsend because some of the major pests that could not be controlled organically otherwise can now be controlled. That said, there's a few caveats. One is that it's not 100%, it's effective, but not as effective as I'd like to be. For instance, if you don't have a good site, for instance, my site is not that great. As far as where pests are coming from, it's going to be a lot less effective. And the other thing is it does leave this white coating on the plant.
I know. But
that's not a negative necessarily. I have some apple trees that I do grow apples here east of the Rocky Mountains. Since I wrote a book on fruit, I should.
Yeah,
so,
you have to.
So my trees, I get a lot of visitors to my garden, and they're always wondering what these trees are. They look sort of cool. They don't look like apple trees. They look like olive trees. It has a very Mediterranean look. The other problem with the coating is if you use it on peaches, it's a little hard to get off.
But the reward at the end of the season, Lee, beats anything I've ever grown.
True, but you could also grow you can grow things like kiwi fruit or grapes or pears, which do not need spraying, and you get a reward also without doing a tenth of that.
Yeah, but I tell you, the amount of fruit I'll get off of a peach tree, even one I've been a little lazy about, just blows my mind.
I think you should be thinning your fruits more.
I'm going to be a better boy this year.
So if you think they're good now and you thin the fruits so that you have 6 to 8 inches between fruits, you'll be blown away by the flavor.
All right. We're all looking forward to your book, Grow Fruit Naturally by Dr. Lee Reich. That's R-E-I-C-H. It's coming out in just a few days. And, Lee, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm glad we caught you passing through your office today.
Yeah.
Thanks for being a good sport and joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you.
Good.
All right, Lee, Dr. Lee Reich, Grow Fruit Naturally, coming out soon. Now get back to that sump pump, young man.
Oh, great. Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Cheryl, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Cheryl, how are you?
Good.
And where is Cheryl Good?
In Slap Out, Alabama.
Say that first part again.
Slap out.
Slap out? That's what women used to do to me all the time.
Yep.
There's
a store here that during the Depression, people would go to the store, and every time they would go, the owner would say, "We're slap out of it."
I see.
So it just took after that.
Oh, that's so funny. Here in Pennsylvania, when I first started working in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, I'd grown up in Philly, but moved out to the Lehigh Valley to work, the expression for that was all. Oh, I'm sorry, the donuts are all.
Oh.
And it took me forever to figure out what people were talking about. I like slap out. All right, what can we do for Cheryl in Slap Out, Alabama?
Well, I'm 48 years old, and I've never had a cat before, but my son came in with one day. So now we have a cat. And we have cat litter.
Mm-hmm.
And I have started composting. And I want to know if I can compost that.
Absolutely not, unfortunately. there are basically, if you want to get down to the two types of things, there's two types of animals. There's animals with, quote, cloven hooves who eat no meat, things like cows and horses. And then there's animals like us and dogs and cats and the big cats and bears who have soft paws that are very porous, and we do eat meat. And both of those avenues are vectors for us to pick up parasites that don't occur in what are called the barnyard animals. So while it's perfectly safe to add some composted horse manure to your compost pile, and it can be very beneficial, even cats that are kept indoors all the time and are regularly seen by a vet can carry parasites and other zoologic diseases, and their waste can never be made safe. And okay. Very frustrating to me, because we used to be a rescue home for Great Pyrenees, giant-sized dogs.
Oh, they're beautiful.
And boy, I wish their you-know-what could be composted, because there was a lot from a creature that size. And I talked to experts at the University of Pennsylvania Veterinary School. I talked to researchers in Alaska, where they have been trying to find a way to do this safely for like 30 years. You know, there's all these sled dogs in Alaska, and the waste from these dogs is a big environmental problem, because, you know, Alaska is all waterways and wetlands. And so far, what has made it safe is nothing a homeowner could ever do. It would have to be done like on an industrial level. So okay. Unfortunately, you know, you're stuck like the rest of us. You scoop out the solid material from the litter and put that in the trash. And then, you know, separately, you put the stinky clay into the trash. It's a sin. I wish there were a better answer, and you are admirable for wanting to recycle this material. But I tell you, people have been working on this problem for decades and decades, and they keep getting skunked. It is, especially with cats, who have this tendency for them to harbor parasites like toxoplasmosis, which are very easy to transmit to humans and which can cause devastating problems. You've heard, of course, that pregnant women should never handle kitty litter. Because of the danger of toxoplasmosis attacking the fetus. And that's absolutely true. But toxoplasmosis will attack you or I or a small child as well. And it can never be adequately explained, but even cats that are inside only and that are regularly seen by vets and wormed, and you would think that every precaution has been taken, their feces will sometimes be found to be contaminated with parasites. It's just a reality of life. The one exception I will make, and it is a very effective tool, but it should not be used very often, is if you get a groundhog take up residence in your garden or near your garden. I shouldn't say in your garden, because you wouldn't do this. You can take a pan of used kitty litter, carefully make sure you get all the solid material out, and then wearing gloves, you can pour the stinky clay down the hole. That groundhog will move. That's a once and done.
I guess you could put it around the perimeter of your property.
You don't even want to do that too much, because then you're putting a lot of bulk down, and then you're like greatly increasing the risk you're going to put some parasites into a waterway somewhere.
Okay.
Now, I wish the answer was different, but this is one where some things that belong in the trash, and this is one of them. And it's not the cat's fault. It's just the way things are.
Right. Well, I also have access to a lot of sawdust.
Right.
And can I compost that, or can I use it to mulch with?
Boy, you are just totally out of luck. You're two for two here.
No.
Yeah, sawdust would turn a garden into a killing field. It's just all carbon, and it would tie up all the nitrogen. If you go to our website, if you go to You Bet Your Garden and click on A to Z Garden Answers and go to Ask for Sawdust, you'll see that some people have tried to manipulate a large amount of coffee grounds with sawdust to try to make compost. But it's a very laborious process. It's hard to get the numbers right. Really, the best thing for your garden is shredded fall leaves.
Okay, yeah, I'm doing that. And then we get a lot of grass this time of year.
And actually, be careful with grass clippings because they can be problematic, and they're best returned to the lawn. They will feed the lawn if you just keep returning the clippings to the lawn. If you keep removing the clippings after you cut the lawn and taking them away, you're starving the lawn. The natural cycle of life would be for the dead grass to feed the live grass.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, Shar. No to the cat and dog waste. No to the sawdust. And grass clippings, they really should be returned to the grass. That's the best use for them. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Good luck. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners who have no land of their own that now is the time to either seek out a plot in a community garden in your area or to join a CSA, a local organic farm in which you can buy a share for the season and receive a share of the produce that farm produces every week. But don't go running to our website for all the details on how to locate the community garden and or CSA nearest you just yet, because we'll be right back with important information about late blight on tomatoes and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. There's still time to catch me at the Delaware Home Show at the Chase Center in Wilmington today, where I'll discuss tomato growing at 1 and correct composting at 3. The Philadelphia Flower Show opens tomorrow and runs through Sunday the 11th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center at 12th and Arch Streets. I'll deliver my annual lecture at the Flower Show and premiere my new book on tomato growing this Wednesday, March 7th at 12:30. On Thursday, March 8th, Professor Doug Tallamy will deliver a native plant lecture at 7:30 p.m. at Cathedral Village in Roxborough, and I'll appear at the Radnor Memorial Library at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 21st. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
We invite you to join us today for Fresh Air Weekend. Nick Flynn and Paul White are our guests. Flynn was working at a homeless shelter when his father, an alcoholic and self-proclaimed writer Flynn never knew as a child, showed up as a client. Flynn wrote about the encounter in his 2004 memoir. Now it's a film starring Robert De Niro as Flynn's father and directed by Paul White, who also directed the film About a Boy. Fresh Air Weekend comes your way at 1 today here on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. Coming up in just a little bit, a very important question of the week. There is information circulating on the internet from a very reliable source that 2012 will be a very bad year for tomato blight because of the warm winter and wet summer. And this information includes details on what these people think you should do to prevent it. There are some real problems with this information. We're going to go right to a plant pathologist at Cornell to get the straight skinny, and we'll have that for you, and you'll know what to do about late blight this coming summer after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, John. How are you, sir?
I'm fine on a day when it's 70 degrees in southeast Kansas. I'm telling you, this is great weather.
And what part of Kansas are we experiencing paradise in?
the corner of southeast Kansas, very close to Joplin, Missouri, where they had that big F5 twister last summer. We are Tornado Alley, right out of Oklahoma. We're right in line with it. We have a twister safe right in our garage we can get to in seconds.
A twister safe? Is that like a storm cellar?
It is, but it's in our garage. It's anchored through our garage floor, and it's been tested both with FEMA and actually in the F5 Joplin, Missouri twister. There were a lot of survivors that had these very types of designs in their garage.
It's like a giant bank safe that you go into?
Exactly. And it was designed by a father and son. One's a welder and the other was an engineer, and they came up with this idea. They built a couple of them, took it to Texas, I believe Austin, Texas, a university down where FEMA has a testing laboratory, and they fired tuba-fours at this thing at over 200 miles an hour. And so it passed, and FEMA certified it. So these things can be built right in your garage, and we've been in that thing many, many times.
I'm so glad to talk to you because I didn't know that things like this existed, and I apologize because I got you off your track. What's your garden question here, John?
Well, we're talking about voles, and that's with a V,
right.
And that stands for varmint.
Yes, it does.
When you go to pick a nice carrot that you've been looking at, you pull it up, and there's nothing under there.
Now, okay, so voles, also known as meadow shrews, are very closely related to those. They're very small underground creatures. They are herbivores. They don't make race tunnels. They make little holes in the ground.
Exactly.
And they have voracious appetites because they have the fastest metabolism of any mammal in North America. And they also breed faster than any other mammal. So
sad to hear that.
Oh, their fecundity is legendary. Now, are you using mulch in your garden?
No, I am not, and I'm in a greenhouse where I've had the attack this winter. I'm a four-season organic gardener, and I've got a greenhouse.
Well, you know,
that's where they came in. I made a mistake, apparently, by putting my compost pile on the north side of my greenhouse wall.
John, I tell you, when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, one of my editors who had a greenhouse said her biggest greenhouse pest was mice.
And I had mice along with the voles, but I handled the mice. I got rid of the mice.
Well, it's the same answer, believe it or not. Put out lots of mouse traps baited with peanut butter.
Exactly what I did, and I've got 14 of them so far.
Yeah, once you see one, you know, I hate to say this, but you might have hundreds. But, you know, you sound like a guy who knows what to do, who's willing to do it. And trapping is the way to go. And
let me ask you, Mike, about one. I've got coal frames inside the greenhouse, and they're just like raised garden beds.
Right.
Only I have them covered with window frames. I dug one of them out that had been attacked on my carrots, and I put 4 inches of, like, pea gravel in there.
I wish you would talk to me first, because I would have recommended you line it with hardware cloth.
Okay, that was my last question. What about hardware cloth?
No, hardware cloth is what the professional bulb forcers use. So hardware cloth is the way to go. And, you know, it's once and done, and they can't push their way through it. Hardware cloth below ground, some peanut butter baited mouse traps above ground, and you should be good.
Excellent.
And in the future, you may want to surround your greenhouse itself with some hardware cloth protection.
I've heard of doing that out about a 4-foot perimeter. I've heard of that.
Yeah. All right, John.
All right, thank you, Mike.
I'm glad we could help. Hardware cloth and mouse traps are the way to go. And thank you for telling us about this new level of tornado protection.
It's twister safe. Yeah, in the Osho, Missouri, All right, you're very welcome, and thank you for the information.
Well, thank you for the information. That's going to be great for a lot of our listeners in your area to know.
Wonderful.
All right, you take care, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Eternity, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Eternity. How are you?
Good.
May I ask how old you are or what grade you're in?
I'm 10 and I'm in 5th grade.
You're in 5th grade. Okay, very good. Oh, and where are you?
Spokane, Washington.
Good, and what can we do for you today?
My parents are getting honeybees to help pollinate our garden, and we'd like to know what type of plants are best for our honeybees and what not to give them.
Now, you know, honeybees are not native to the United States. These are creatures that originally came from Africa. They were domesticated in Europe. And now a lot of people have them. There's honeybee colonies in just about every part of the world. But they're not native bees. So the most important thing you can do, whether you have a honeybee hive in your backyard or whether you want to attract native bees and keep them happy, is never to use pesticides, even organic pesticides. And people don't necessarily understand that. But there are some organic pesticides that are very safe for people to use, but you have to be very careful. Bees can be very fragile. So even a spray that may be labeled that it's safe for organic gardens or safe for organic gardeners should not be used around bees. Oddly enough, you also don't want to have any bird houses near your beehive because there are a great number of birds that eat bees. The important thing for bees is that you have something in flower as many parts of the year as possible. In other words, you want plants that bloom really early in the season. Bees especially love fruiting plants, apple trees, peach trees, cherry trees, lots of blossoms. They're loaded with pollen and nectar. They bloom very early in the season when the bees are enormously hungry for food. One of the plants that bees love most is clover. Did you ever notice a lot of times in the spring in people's lawns, you'll see a round white flower head coming up over the grass?
Yeah.
That's clover, and clover comes in all different colors. You can get red clovers, you can get white clovers. Bees love going to clover, but there's very few plants that produce pretty flowers that bees won't like. So bees like azaleas, they like fruit trees, they like just about anything that'll flower. And they like big blocks of color. If you can get a big shrub, like there's a plant called bee balm, B-E-E-B-A-L-M. And obviously that's considered to be one of the number one bee-attracting plants. And one of the reasons it attracts so many bees is the plant gets covered in red flowers, and the bees can see it at a distance. A whole bunch of bees can feed on the pollen and nectar at the same time. So bees like flowers. They like flowers in bloom at all times of the year, and they like big clusters of one big flowering plant that's all the same color. And you do any of those things, and you will have a lot of honey at the end of the season. The big enemy of bees is pesticides. It's really important once you establish a beehive that you go around to your neighbors and ask them to be especially careful and not spray anything anywhere where the wind can drift it over onto your property, because that could harm your bees. It's really two things. It's not hurting the bees with pesticides, and it's making sure there's these big blocks of colorful flowers so they can feed whenever they want.
Okay.
You're going to help take care of the hive? You're going to sweep it out for your mom and dad? You're going to collect the honey at the end of the season?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we hope you do well. We hope this was helpful, and good luck with your honeybee hive.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. This week it's about tomatoes, and we're wondering, is there a bad blight on the rise? You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, who's our question from this week?
Well, Mike, Adam from Landenburg, Pennsylvania writes, I just read a post from someone at an heirloom seed company regarding the potential for bad tomato blight this season. I was curious to see if you agreed with the warning and suggestions that that person made. What do you think?
Well, here's the post that Adam was reacting to. Quote, late blight is going to be a problem for tomatoes, potatoes, and possibly eggplants during the 2012 season. The moisture that inundated the East Coast over the summer and extraordinarily mild winter have combined to create an unusually comfortable environment for the proliferation of blight spores, which can lay dormant in soil and be carried by the wind as far as 50 miles in a day. Those who intend to grow potato, tomato, or eggplant must take precautions early. We suggest that you use the powder form of copper, a fungicide approved for organic farming. Dust the soil with copper where you're going to plant your tomatoes, potatoes, and eggplants. Till some dust into the soil, then dust the seedlings at planting time and repeat this dusting twice over the next month. And if you observe signs of blight later in the season, dust them again. If you follow these suggested protocols, your plants will probably be okay, but if you do nothing, you may lose your entire potato, tomato, or eggplant crop. Pretty dire warnings, huh, Alexis?
Absolutely.
Well, the recent rainfall of last summer and the recent warm winter do have a lot of gardeners worried about a lot of things. But you know, so far, every concern I brought to the attention of experts has elicited a big don't worry. However, you know that late blight is a really nasty actor, and so I forwarded this warning to the researcher who guided us through the most recent outbreaks of this devastating disease, Dr. Margaret Tuttle McGrath, no relation, honest, from the Cornell University Department of Plant Pathology, Long Island Horticultural Research and Extension Center in Riverhead, New York. Here's her response. Meg says that while I agree that late blight could be a big problem in 2012, it would not be because of dormant spores surviving a mild winter. As we've explained in past seasons, it would be due to the pathogens surviving in infected potato tubers that were left in the soil or in compost piles last season or from infected tubers that people would plant this spring. Because without a potato host, the late blight pathogen can't survive in soil over winter, at least not yet. There is the possibility that if the pathogen were able to achieve sexual reproduction, which it has not yet been able to do in the U.S., it could form a type of spore that could survive winter. But it's not happening yet, and this is another good reason to aggressively manage late blight when it appears. The fewer diseased leaves there are in the environment, the less chance of this nasty thing happening. Meg continues, again, the late blight pathogen can and does survive in infected potato tubers, and these tubers have been the primary source of the pathogen appearing in each of the last few seasons, not spores in or on the soil. So the proper precautions to take to avoid late blight becoming established again are 1. Destroy any potato tubers that survive the winter and any volunteer plants that develop from them. Tubers often sprout in the compost pile or in the garden from potatoes that were missed at harvest time the previous season. 2. Purchase and plant only certified disease-free seed potatoes. This is very important. 3. Inspect your potato and tomato plants routinely from day one for symptoms of late blight. We'll post all those symptoms in great detail with links from this question of the week on our website. 4. Monitor usablight.org to find out where late blight is occurring and sign up to get alerts that'll warn you if it's showing up in your area. 5. Apply fungicides to the plant's leaves, not soil, on a preventative schedule. Diseased plant tissue cannot be cured and must be immediately destroyed when discovered. Meg continues that eggplants are highly unlikely to be affected. While it is possible that evolution could result in a new strain that might be able to infect them, it's highly unlikely, it hasn't happened, and applying copper or other treatments preventatively on eggplants is not warranted. Now, Meg goes on to say, In addition, I don't recommend applying copper to soil and have never seen such a use described on the label of a copper fungicide. And she points out, if a pesticide is used in a manner that does not conform to that label, it's a violation of federal law. That label is a legal document. Perhaps most importantly, she adds, earthworms and other beneficial organisms are sensitive to copper, and copper applied directly to the soil is much more likely to reach these organisms in toxic doses than any copper you would spray on the leaves of your plants. And she concludes by saying, that's why I prefer copper in liquid form. With liquid, you get much better coverage of the leaves with much less soil involvement, especially if you don't spray it until it drips off those leaves. And liquid formulations also contain what are called stickers to help keep the copper on the plant leaves and off of people. The precautionary statement on copper fungicide labels, she adds, indicates that it can be harmful to people if inhaled, swallowed, absorbed through the skin, or if it comes in contact with your eyes. Meg concludes by saying all of the copper fungicides she knows of that are marketed to farmers are in liquid form. Well, that sure was an authoritative look at the prospects for and prevention of late blight on your precious tomatoes, now wasn't it? Luckily for yous, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to spray me with sulfur if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime. At 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your target, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been L. Banks. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Blight-free Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, L. Banks, is keeping an eye out for rogue potatoes. I'm your dangerous spud, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Growers rejoice, the soil will soon unfreeze. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss which plants can be moved around easily in the spring and why winter moves are a bad idea. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Daffodils, daisies, dogwood, the denizens of spring are dependably doing their thing. And Mike definitely feels advice on making it all delightful. Join us for You Bet Your Garden Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY. Support.